Hey everybody, I'm Sarah Century. This is Bitches on Comics. Welcome to my co-host.
Hi, I'm Essie Fleetor. Oh, Sarah, you're my favorite. And today we have a very special guest. I am freaking pumped. We have Rhea Brodel. Hi, Rhea.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your whole bag?
Well, I am an artist. I primarily have been working in what they call drawing, but sometimes I call painting. works on paper, narrative-based, and I also am a teacher, and I'm based in Boston these days.
You stay busy, it seems like.
I do, yeah, or try to.
Amazing. One of the reasons we're super pumped to have Rhea here is their incredible project, which is called Butch Heroes. If you've been listening to the podcast, you've probably heard about Butch Heroes on episode 35, where we made it our comic of the week, as we like to think of comics as, hey, you know, you got some pictures, you got some words. That's a comic for us. So we are super pumped to have you here, Rhea. We are just like so excited to talk about this project, which is just in so many ways a love story for queer communities and gender variant history. And that feels so special. So thank you for taking the time to talk with us. I'd love to start with just when someone asks you, when they're like, Rhea, what is this Butch Heroes? Like, what do you tell them? How do you describe the project?
Yeah, good question. Well, one, first I say that it's like something that stemmed from just a personal exploration. I was really curious how queer folks lived throughout history, like how we made a life for ourselves, how we survived, what we did, how we communicated, how we found each other. And yeah, that's how it started, like me kind of trying to answer that question, that just curiosity. And so I start with that. And then I tell them that it's a painting series primarily. It started as research-based paintings and portraits. And then it became a book because I realized that the stories and the paintings went together. And I really wanted to also share my sources. And yeah, that's generally how I talk about it.
It's a very factually accurate, you know, like it feels very like, let me hit you with the highlights. For me, it's like I said, like a love story. And it is so emotionally potent. Mm-hmm. Like every single story that you have researched and crafted the way that you have, it's just, I guess the way I think of it is it's like another hole in the facade of queerness being new, right? Like we're told right. All the time that like there's only two genders and, you know, People were straight throughout history. And we're like, I know that's not true. Exactly. And now it's like I have a book of evidence, you know?
Yeah, totally. And that was really, really important to me, that aspect of like to show the facts, like to show like, hey, I wanted to find as many people as I could. I wanted to outline all of my sources so I could say like, this is the truth. We have always been here. We're not like, you know, unnatural in any way. We're not a 21st century invention. We've been here. And if anything, history was way more diverse than we know.
The whole design of the book is just gorgeous, but I really appreciated the cover and the way that when you open it, it feels like it's going to be a treasure trove kind of. And of course, that is what it is. But I kind of was just wondering, how did the packaging of this book come together? Because it has such a unique look to it that I just thought it was interesting and was wondering what involvement you had in that.
Yeah, definitely. The MIT Press version is kind of how I wanted it to be from the beginning. Like, I knew early on in the painting series that I wanted it to be a book. And because the paintings were based off of Catholic holy cards, I wanted that book to kind of look religious as well. So I immediately thought of like, you know, when you're in a Catholic church, in the pew in front of you, usually there's a missal, which is like usually a brown or a red or a black leather book with a ribbon or multiple ribbons. And in it, like it's the hymns and some prayers and things like that. And I wanted the style of the book to kind of mimic that, to go with that kind of Catholic vibe. But when I made the first version of the book, I self-published it, and that was way out of my price range. So,
right.
So I did my best. Like it was still, you know, referencing the Catholic Church. But then when I handed that copy to MIT Press and I told them what I had envisioned, it's what they came back to me with. And yeah, they surprised me with that.
That's so interesting. I had no idea that you had self-published initially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's your relationship with self-publishing? Have you done like a lot of that or?
No, this was the first time I knew I wanted it to be a book. So I asked a lot of my mostly photographer friends because they are more familiar with making books of their work. And it was just so daunting. I was like, okay, well, I had no idea how to find a publisher or get an agent or any of that kind of thing. And so I just started researching self-publishing houses, and I found one in Berkeley, California called Edition One. And I chose them mostly because, well, they had a price calculator right on their website, which was really handy.
Right.
And they let me do a really small edition, and I could really customize it to be how I wanted it. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
So I just got finished rereading the article that Essie did through Sci-Fi. I was curious because there's some conversation about, obviously, the importance of religious aesthetic in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But also, as somebody who's done a bunch of research, you know, I'm kind of like a history nerd. I was kind of more curious, I guess, about how you did research for this. Like, was it something that you just were kind of casually doing, or did you always go into it being like, I'm going to make this?
It definitely was like targeted. First, it was pretty casual. Like first it was like, okay, what is there available to me? Like what can I find? And that was just like at first going to the public library and getting kind of frustrated with what the public library had in their collection in terms of queer books. It was very male centric, mm-hmm. very European, lots of stuff on Rome.
Right.
And that is not at all
like
what
that's
I wanted.
The epitome of queerness.
Yeah, oh my totally. God. Not at all what I wanted. But then again, like it's probably improved since then because I started this in 2010. So
sure, yeah.
There was not a lot of books that I could find on trans stuff. Non-binary wasn't in our language yet. I mean, it might have been, but I didn't come across it till recently. And so it was kind of rough at first, just trying to find where to look. But libraries are really helpful. And luckily in Boston, I have a lot of libraries around me. So,
right.
And then from there, like as I would find names of people, then that would direct me to different places. So like newspaper archives and other databases and things like that, or other types of collections. So it just depends on the painting itself and the direction I need to go.
Right. I definitely have spent a lot of time because I think that that's something that people don't always intrinsically understand when you talk about queer history is you're mm-hmm. just like, I have to go to archives. Mm-hmm. Like I have to travel, you know, it's like I'll hear that there's a queer run zine library in Milwaukee and be like, I got to go check that out. You know, I've got to go see that library. And the things that you see in that library, you don't see anywhere else. It's not universally tracked. So I think that that's part of why I was so compelled by Butch Heroes. It's so nice because it's like the missing pieces of a puzzle, right? Mm-hmm. Just kind of all filling in.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's something really intriguing to me about that process, I guess.
Yeah. And I have to say that like, I'm thankful to all of the researchers that did this work before me too, because without their help, like without archivists, without people like, you know, digitizing things, who knows, like what I could find would have been even more limited. So I can't imagine had I done this project like before the internet, it's impossible.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
What was the moment that made this move from an idea to a project?
Yeah, good question. I'm trying to remember. I mean, I'm actually thinking about that moment a lot these days because it is like it's been 10 years working on this project. So I've been in it for so long that I kind of forget what it's like to be in a stage where you're sort of navigating like a new project. But I remember finishing up or feeling like I was finishing up the previous project, which was a project called The Handsome and the Holy. And it was similar. It was not super text heavy. It was kind of painting vignettes on paper, like a lot of self-portraiture. And I was finishing that up. And that's what kind of spurred the question of, you know, how did we survive in history? How would I have survived? I had done a piece looking to myself like in the future, like as kind of a joke. And then I was like, oh, yeah, well, what about the past? Like, what if I was born into a different century? And I was just kind of ruminating on that. And I started to kind of do the research, but then I wasn't sure what form it would take. And I have a lot of kind of awkward drawings from that time where it's kind of not like Butcheros is in there, but it's not quite in there. Like there's one where I'm like hanging out with Catalina de Rosso or Antonio, and we are like wearing similar clothing, like kind of conquistador garb, and we're having a sword fight. Or there's another drawing I made where we're sitting on a bench in a park and we're exchanging, you remember those like best friend necklaces where the heart would break in half?
Yeah,
totally. So it was like these awkward pieces before Butch Heroes where I was trying to figure out like, what is it going to look like, you know?
Oh my gosh. I hope those drawings, if the next volume comes together, I hope you'll put them in back matter. I would like die to see those. That sounds adorable. When I look at this project, so much of what I see is it's both an act of telling history, but it's also an act of creation, right? Mm. To create ourselves through the stories we tell each other. Yeah. And so to see that you like literally inserted yourself into these historical moments, like that's so cute. I love it.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a little bit more. Like I'd forgotten about those early drawings and I was like thinking about the next direction of this. Like what if I continued on that theme, you know, like maybe I'm like painting with Rosa Bonheur or something in the park or I don't know. But
oh, I love it. Well, I'm excited to see what that I don't know becomes. I feel like that's such a part of my creative process where totally. Like I'm in the I don't know phase. So yep. I'm just brainstorming and doing things and hating them and loving them and feeling very confused.
Exactly. Yeah, it's so... It's so weird in that phase, but simultaneously kind of fun. I guess I have to remember or maybe take my own advice sometimes. Like I talk to my students, like when they're trying to figure out their ideas and what to do. And I'm like, well, what are you most excited about? You know, like you should do what you're most excited about.
I love that. Yeah. I write novels and I was in a class where I was just like, I was not sure, you know, I was like at a place with my novel where I hated it. I'd been working on it so long. And I asked the teacher, I was like, how do you know when to give up? And it's similar advice. She said, you know, when you're bored with it.
Yeah.
Like if you're bored with the story, none of your readers are going to be into it, no matter how long you've been on it. So if you're bored, give up on it. But if you're not bored, it's worth pushing through. Yeah, and that was like a defining moment for me because it was like, oh, I was conflating going through a very hard revision with, you know, giving up, whereas I was just having a hard time.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, I don't know where I'm at with Bucciero's. Like, it's been 10 years. I've made a lot of paintings since the book came out. So I would like to have another volume to show those paintings as well. But listening to myself, how to know, like, when to move on or, like, and also it's been such a big part of my life for so long, like, kind of feeling guilty about even thinking about moving on, you know?
Yeah. But then you have to remember, Jennifer Aniston played Rachel for 10 years, you know?
Like, that's so true.
It worked out for her. Not that Friends is good, but like it worked out for her career. So I don't
know. That's true.
I was actually thinking of Melissa Joan Hart and how long she was on sitcoms. Like 20 years she was on sitcoms.
How long she was on Sabrina alone, because like that was hilarious because the whole time she's the teenage witch and then it's like, no, it's been like 10 years.
You're 27.
And weirdly, you do still look like you're 15.
Yeah, totally.
It's okay, but it's weird.
Oh, that's funny.
And there were also 3 Sabrina movies. See, this is what we're saying in the tangents. We're like, you know, these are the things we worry about is the Sabrina movies. So I'm actually curious if you could tell, you know, our listeners a little bit about the paintings themselves and, you know, where they can view them or like, are they in a gallery? Like, I would love to hear about that.
I was curious too, because you've done museum exhibits, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's so cool.
Yeah, they are in some different collections around. So a number of them, I want to say 14 of them maybe, are at the Davis Museum at Wellesley College. So you can, I think currently, because they had them on view, I can't remember when, but they had them on view for a year. And so because they work on paper, they have to rest. And so they are going to be resting for 3 years in the prints and drawings room. So you can still request to see them, but they're not on view. And then there's a few at the Minneapolis Museum of American Art. There's one that's going to be on view at the Henry Art Gallery in Seattle as part of a group show. Actually, I just found that today. The show is called Plural Possibilities and the Female Body, and it talks about all the stuff around that, like basically just differences in gender, like what that means, challenging the traditional conceptions of beauty and a fixed gender binary. That's off of their website. So I'm pretty excited about having a piece in that show. So if you're in Seattle or Minneapolis or here around Boston. Yeah.
That's so cool. And then you also host some on your website, correct?
Yes, they're all on my website and it's up to date with all of the paintings. And then I usually use my Instagram to show process shots or, you know, make announcements about shows or talks or things like that.
And your website is riabrodel.com, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And your handle is at Rhea Bradell.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. We'll have that all in the show notes, folks. So if you don't know how to spell anything, don't panic. Just come on over to our website, bitchesoncomics.com, and all the info will be there in today's episode's show notes. I think this is like an interesting segue too, because talking about the plural possibilities and the female body, we talked about this before, and I kind of have to feel my way through the question. Sure. Because I want to talk about the word butch. And yes. I want to talk about the way your project resists the gender binary and resists labels. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of what's really important about what you're doing here. Yeah. And so I'd love to know, like, how did you settle on the word butch? When you use it, what does it mean to you? Mm-hmm. And how does that reflect in, yeah, again, resisting these sort of labels and binaries that we're told are important?
Definitely. Yeah. And I think my choice in using the word butch has been like probably the thing that's caused the most, I don't know, controversy is a tough word, but I could say controversy, like, because there are people who are very, very attached to the word butch, and I'm using it in a way that's a little bit more broad, I suppose. And I'm using it because it's a term that's familiar to everyone. And it's a term that has a history in the queer community, specifically the lesbian community. But it also just means strong and masculine and tough and fearless. And it's a word that also was kind of, as a kid, kind of thrown around in a derogatory way towards me. And I wasn't sure, like, why. I knew the choice would probably be kind of tough for some folks because I am not using contemporary terminology for the people in the book, the people that I've chosen to paint, because I don't know how they would specifically identify if they were given all the choices that we have.
Right.
But I still think butch is an appropriate term because it means just that. It means tough and masculine and courageous, and that's what I want.
I think about how every single story is something that is kind of aspirational, even though it's very tragic a lot of the time. Like, these are stories where you're giving the context and saying, you know, a lot of times, like, what records do we have of somebody, you know, hundreds of years later? And usually it's like, well, their birth, their death, you know, like a couple of other details.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, there's all of these scenes of tragedy in the book, of course, you know. But at the same time, it's kind of a hopeful book. It's definitely a book that made me cry and also be really inspired at the same time, because I just think that, as you call them heroes, like, I think that that's an important word to discuss as well, because a lot of times, yeah, they are heroes, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of an interesting thing to think about, because a lot of times the heroic thing that they're doing in this book is just being who they are. There's parts where this person was told that they can't keep dressing this way or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then they did. And then that led to their deaths, you know, and stuff like that. It really is so heroic to read.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Each story is different. And each story is, yeah, whether it ended tragically or whether it ended in a way like we maybe don't know what happened. That happens more often than not, like not knowing how their lives ended up after they came to fame. But I think just like existing the way they did, fighting to live the lives that they wanted to live is heroic in itself.
Yeah, I mean, so often that's what would bring me to tears is not the horrific ramifications of their bravery, which, you know, not every story ends terribly, but plenty do.
Mm-hmm.
But really, instead, it was the audacity to know that could happen and still live your life for you. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt so inspired, especially, you know, in this time of Trump, which is drawing to a close. The fear has been so high. And that's, you know, Trump is not the reason, blah, blah, blah. Yes, I get it. Everyone who wants to now at me, please do. I love you. At me all you want. But I think that there's something to be said in a time, you know, and it's really the last decade, and in times when we are seeing trans people being discriminated against, murdered, when we're seeing queer people be discriminated against, attacked, murdered, it's really powerful to say, yes, this hatred has existed, but this diversity of gender, this diversity of sexuality, this diversity of an experience in one's body has too. Yeah. And so there's a resilience there, and a, you know, it's like the way that when I think about Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, I feel stronger, you know, because I can look at an ancestor who put their ass on the line for all of us.
Yeah.
And that makes me feel connected to a history in a way that, you know, again, our society is deeply vested in divorcing us from. So I think that it's important, like Sarah said, the word heroes is so important because we have to be able to see what being a hero means in these specific contexts and to take courage to be like heroic in our own ways, right? Like to not put myself away Sometimes for safety, I do here and there, whatever. Everyone's got to make their choices. But it feels totally. It feels incredible to know, God damn it, I'm not alone. And I've never been alone. Exactly.
Like, that's what I think, like, I didn't expect this project to do for me. Like, I just started it because I was curious and I wanted to, you know, I'm an artist and it was a project I thought of and didn't really think past that. But what happened was it ended up giving me a lot more confidence to be in the body I have, a lot more confidence to like identify however I want. Mm. And to just know that, like, yeah, that we have ancestors, we have a history, and to know, like, if they can do this, I can do this too. We can all live our lives.
I love it. I wanted to talk a little bit about the idea of like the Catholic holy cards. Mm-hmm. And then for you, what is the religious or spiritual aspect, or is there one for you?
I'm not Catholic anymore. And I don't know, I have a complicated relationship with it. It currently, like I would say, has been making me very angry, probably because of the election and a lot of my Catholic relatives, like being Trump supporters only because they're pro-life, makes no sense to me. And so my relationship with Catholicism in this moment is very tense. Whereas in the past, even though I haven't been Catholic since I was probably 17 or 18, it was a relationship of sort of nostalgia and still some comfort and still some, like, I almost said admiration. I don't think admiration is the right word, but just like a little bit of respect still. And now I'm like, no, it's part of my history. And I still love the iconography and I love the stories, but it makes me sad now. I don't really think of myself as a spiritual person anymore. Yeah, I don't know. And that's also something that I like am kind of grappling with.
That can be a reclamation in and of itself though, right? Like, using this imagery that's so important to you, mm-hmm. is, you know, kind of like a nice way to be able to turn it around a little bit, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, I still love the imagery. I love the saints, and I love the, like, man, like, St. Francis is still one of my like all-time favorite peeps. But like, I don't know, like, Catholicism itself, the dogma and the hierarchy and all of the baggage is just very problematic. And
yeah, I think a lot about how I don't see a reconciliation path for me in Christianity, and it's mm-hmm. not important to me in any mm-hmm. ways. I have like a Catholic side and like a Protestant side of my family. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's just like twice the baggage. Delightful. But yeah, I wanted to ask, because also when I look at the paintings, I've recently started getting into tarot, and Sarah's like, you can't talk about tarot in every episode. And actually, she's fine with it. She's like, oh, what part?
Can this just be a tarot podcast? I'm into it.
We are not even going to change our name. We're just going to start doing tarot solely.
Bitches on tarot.
I've never done tarot. I've never had it's something I'm curious about. Like, I'm definitely more into like astrology these days, but
nice. Same. But yeah. Also, this just means that you're going to have this amazing experience whenever you finally do get your tarot card reading.
Cool.
Awesome. Totally. Because I could totally see you have, like, I could totally see a Butch Heroes tarot deck, just like nice. For the record. Like,
yeah, I get that a lot, actually. I think interesting. It's very similar imagery, right? Like, or style, I would say.
Yeah. And I think there's something about the way that personages may or may not like hold your gaze. Mm-hmm. Like that mm-hmm. feels really powerful in the different cards. To me, there is a real spirituality to it. And I'm using spirituality because I'm like, I don't know whatever other word to use. It's like,
yeah,
there's an ushy gushiness to it. There's like something that we don't have good language for.
Yeah, totally.
That I feel when I look at these images.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about it with like how I was talking about, you know, Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson. It's like, I do think that's something that Catholic people have, is like a very clear connection to where their religion comes from. Mm-hmm. Is it a like sanitized version that has like some real political influence? Absolutely.
Yeah.
However, there is the gift of like, I come from this experience. And, you know, I'm even thinking about Black spirituality and how different hymns tell these stories mm-hmm. of how Black Americans survived enslavement.
Yeah.
And I think that Butch Heroes gives us a chance of having a sort of, yes, cognitive, intellectual connection with that, but also this emotional one that feels like it's not just my feelings, even though it is my feelings, but also like my resonance of like where I'm supposed to be in the world, why I'm supposed to be here. Things that I see people get from religion and I don't get from that experience. Some of that I do get here and I get it from books, you know, I'm like books are my religion for sure. So it makes sense in a way. But
yeah, and that's a good point. Like I think about that a lot. Like what did I get from that experience? Like Catholicism for me was a connection mostly to those stories and to my family, like mostly my grandma and my aunts, because they were the ones that told me the stories of the saints. And I miss that part of it. I guess that would be the spiritual aspect. Like I remember as a kid, just knowing that, like, you know, my grandma would tell me to pray to such and such a saint for this, such and such a thing. And just have that comfort to be able to like really believe in that and be like, I'm going to be okay, because I can pray to Saint Jude or whatever. And I kind of envy that, you know, but at the same time, like, I know that I get that from other places now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it gets to be your imagery too, you know, like, it's not the same. I read comics a lot though, and there's always times where people are just like, well, you have to do this or do that in order to be considered a fan of it or something. And I'm like, no, I get to be a fan of it too, because I grew up with it.
Yeah.
Basically, anything that you grow up with, you're like, no, it's mine too. Like, I get to also be a person who defines this, you know, like it can't just all be other people's voices.
Yeah, so it's part of your story.
Totally. That's what I think.
Yeah.
Hey, listeners, if you don't already, you can join us over on Patreon. We do all kinds of bonus content, bonus episodes where we review our favorite TV and films, sometimes just like random things that we're like, hey, want to review this weird thing that's on DC Universe? I think I do. And it is a delight. We also have reading lists that are drawn from our episodes every month that tell you where you can learn more about the shows and the comics that we name drop quickly as we go through a very intense list of things, because it's who we are. And we want you to join us. You can join us at any level, as little as $2 a month, as much as, hey, you name it, and we will give you this content, share it with you, and you can be even more of a support to a podcast we know you love as you listen to us right now. I'm curious for you, you know, you talked about a sort of catalyst for all of this was a personal exploration. Mm-hmm. You're a decade in. How is your personal journey around your gender, your sexuality, around, you know, being a painter, being a teacher? How are those things influenced, or how have they changed, or how do you see them reflected in where Butch Heroes is today?
Yeah, that's a tough question. Wow, I don't even know where to start. I think it's because of the place I'm at right now with Butch Heroes. I'm in a place where I didn't anticipate being, and I think it has a lot to do with COVID. And I think it has a lot to do with where we are right now in our society, like just amplified injustices and the election. And I've been questioning a lot whether the project needs to shift, whether I don't know. I'm usually pretty hard at work right away. Like after I finish one painting, I'm right to the next one, right? And I finished one, I don't remember when, but it's been tough to get back into it. It's very hard to focus and to concentrate. And I'm usually not that person. So I'm in a point where I'm like, okay, like, what does it look like now? I'm trying to listen to myself, basically, like to listen to like what it has taught me and where it needs to go. And I don't know, like I'm starting to also think about, I set out very, very specific criteria when I started the project because I wanted to keep it very, very personal. And I wanted to answer that question, like, how would I have survived? And now that criteria is kind of becoming kind of like I'm feeling like I want to break out. Like I want to like not be stuck with criteria anymore. I want to investigate more things about gender and sexuality and maybe our history or maybe our future, you know, but I don't know what that looks like, but I'm feeling it. And I'm like, okay, because I'm feeling this, I need to like kind of pay attention and figure out what's next.
I always make Sarah tell me what my horoscope is. She's like, I've pieced it together.
I strictly read Johnny Nicholas right now, but there was one that I really like. It was just like, okay, holy crap. It struck me in the heart, you know. I feel like it was the one around the full moon or something. I can't remember. But yeah, there's like lots of changes, right?
Yeah, it is a time of change. My tarot cards keep being like, bitch, shit's changing. And I'm like, I'm aware. Like, how is that helpful? And it's like, I don't know. It's on you.
I know. Maybe I need to get my tarot read or something.
Might be a good time. Might be a good time. Man. Do you have like an inkling of what any of the lessons you've learned are? Or is that still like forming for you?
Oh, I've definitely learned a lot about our history and the multitudes of ways that gender and sexuality were expressed through time by different cultures. Like, that is huge. I've learned a lot of kind of fun things that I kind of want to do something with, like weird euphemisms and terminology for, like, you know, lifeless instruments, let's just say.
Hell yes. I love it. So, that's a tarot deck I'd read. Tell you that. Just lifeless instruments.
Yeah. Artificial organs. There's a whole bunch of them.
Oh my gosh. I love it.
Yeah, I'm still ruminating on that for sure, but I've definitely like learned a lot over the last 10 years.
This is just reminding me, I had a zine that was called Lesbian Lexicon, and it just was a bunch of terms, some of which you can keep, some of which I was like, I'm not fond of that. Send it right back.
Yeah.
But a bunch of which that I was just like, I cannot believe somebody made words for this. Oh my God.
Yeah, man, there's a lot of them. I should have really been keeping track throughout this whole 10 years and like keeping a list, you know, but yeah. So now if I do anything with it, I'll have to go back and revisit everything. Could be fun.
Yeah, I hope you do. That sounds hilarious. I was just watching the movie Friendsgiving, which is a new film that came out by a queer writer and director. And it's about like her Thanksgiving that she had a couple years ago with like a straight friend, and she's a lesbian. And at one point, the character who's kind of her takes mushrooms and sees her three very gay mothers. And it is Margaret Cho, Fortune Feimster, and Wanda Sykes. Whoa. And it is so fucking funny because they just start being like, you're going to find your person. She might be a daddy dyke. She might be a mommy dyke. She might be a baby dyke. And then they just start naming all these terms that I was just like in tears. Just like, and that's what it makes me remind me of. It's just like we create words to be able to express ourselves. And it's so... Humans are so incredible and resilient, you know?
Yeah, words and visuals and, you know, tools and, it's great.
I love us. We'll just find a way to do anything. If there's a sex act you can think of, we have done it.
Probably.
Like that about us.
We being like...
Me and Sarah, specifically. Can you imagine? That's a whole different podcast.
It's good to do new things, right?
Oh, that's... Oh my gosh. So we haven't really talked about your teaching at all, and I've been super curious about that.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what you teach, you know, who your students are. I mean, not their names and their social security numbers probably, but like who do you enjoy working with, and I think so often we think of teaching as something people do on the side instead of like if it is something that isn't your primary work. Or is my experience of teachers is there's a mission behind it. So like, what's your mission behind that work as well?
Oh yeah. That's like always, it's always been like this kind of, there's a lot of folks, especially in the art community, that think like, oh, you know, an artist shouldn't be teaching. But I find that, man, I learned the most from teachers that were artists and artists that are teachers. And I feel like it is something I didn't anticipate doing, but kind of thankfully fell into it. And it really like helps my artistic practice in that like I stay engaged and I love talking with my students. Mostly like my favorite thing is talking with them about their ideas on an individual level. I love seeing like when they get excited about an idea and a project. And I've taught a lot of different classes, mostly in the painting and drawing area, but I've also done printmaking. And shortly while the book was coming out, I also like designed a course on painting and gender and sexuality. And that was the first time I was able to really incorporate kind of my own research into a class that I designed. And it was great. It was like a really tough challenge, I think, particularly because at the time I went through art school, we didn't have gender and sexuality studies. We didn't have like any of those types of courses. So I sort of designed the class from my own research and my own kind of background a little bit, but it worked out pretty well. And it was pretty fun to teach that class. And then, I don't know, yeah, I've taught everybody from like high school students to, you know, adults. And right now I'm mostly teaching college age students. So
that is so cool. Also, it's really awesome that you got to put that class together. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was fun. It was like, at first when I was asked to like design a class, I was like, okay, how do I, like, it should be like, the idea was that would it be an interdisciplinary class kind of cross-listed between the gender and sexuality studies department and the painting department. And so mm-hmm. I was like, okay, this is going to be great. And it was like, it was so difficult to decide what to put in the class because there's just so much. There's no way it can all be covered in one semester.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I've noticed too, I do mentorship sometimes, which is very different than teaching, but it's kind of similar sometimes. And everything I know about gender, I feel like I learned from people who were like 15 years old or something. I'm just like, wow, I never thought about that. Like all of my vocabulary had to catch up, and Gen Z definitely was teaching me a thing or two. That's for sure. So
totally. I'm learning new stuff from my students constantly. It's
Yeah. That's nature of the beast, I hope, because that's kind of like, that's the good part of being a teacher. Like we always, as a society, kind of focus on things that are, you know, obviously logistically a problem, teachers not getting paid enough and all of the responsibility that teachers take. But then it's like every teacher who I've ever met is just like always can tell me what they truly love about their job, too. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
For me, whenever I get to teach, it's always such a beautiful reminder, too, of the basics. Like, I have to really think about, like, what makes you cry when you read a story, right? And it's like, oh, it's this thing we call theme. Or it's, like, the veracity of it all. You have to, like, kind of, like, make that make sense to someone else.
Yeah, how do you break it down, right? How do you break down these concepts that are just, like, I don't know. Sometimes they're, like, so, like, I forget. Like, the beginning of this semester, I was teaching two sections of beginning painting on Zoom, which is quite an adventure. Wild. But I like maybe the third class in, one of them was like, "Professor, can you tell us how to clean our brushes?" And I was like, "Oh crap, like sorry, I totally forgot how to." Because it's just so like, it didn't even occur to me.
Oh, I love that. You know, I took a couple different like gender and sexuality courses in different institutions and times in my education. And I was just thinking about how, you know, there really has to be one in every discipline. Like you just have to, because again, the people who've created academia, the people who have created all the rules by which we know what learning is are like, you know, predominantly cishet white men with a few cishet white women. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be flawed, right? So
yeah.
A tool that is flawed has to be used to sort of like turn it back on itself and reflect on like, okay, so you've been told that when you do life drawing, you draw men like this and women like this. Well, mm-hmm. guess what, friends? Like, that's not real. You know? And I remember I was in a philosophy class and we were reading a book by a female philosopher who was like very big on like talking about motherhood and like what challenges does it present to being, you know, a feminist? And then like right after that, reading Judith Butler and my professor being like, so what do you think now? We're all just like, I don't know what to think. You've blown up my whole life. And that's like such an important experience, I think, as we break down the gender binary and or at least the givenness of the gender binary. I don't care if people want to identify as woman or man, more power to you. But I hope as we break down the binary, we can all understand that those are placeholder words. They describe something that doesn't have language. Gender is not, sexuality is not something that we can like sit around in a group and like dissect and be like, oh yes, when everyone says they feel feminine, that means the same thing. No deviation, right? We're all on this. It's like, no. My partner has been thinking a lot about their femininity and like how they want to express it, what it means to them. And sometimes will ask me questions and I'm like, oh, I don't, my brain turns into the dial-up noise whenever I hear the word feminine. I'm just like, I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't know what that word means.
That's such a good explanation. Yeah, I like kind of shut down myself, actually.
So. Yeah. I do it with masculine too, where I'm just like, I don't know. People all the time will be like, so do you think it I'll offend non-binary people if I write feminine here? And I'm like, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. I'm not offended, but I genuinely don't know what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we, I don't know, like, these terms are like changing all the time. They're totally arbitrary. They're so personal. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just, as you were saying, they're changing all the time. I just flashed to Wynonna Earp because they have a character who is, you know, Doc Holliday, but he's from the 1800s. And so he comes back and he's like, you would look so pretty in a nice feminine blue. It's like a woman he's flirting with. And then he gets into his car, which is like bright pink. And he's like, oh, pink, so masculine. And it's just like really cute and like tongue in cheek. Cause it's like, yeah, these things that we think of as given are so recently determined, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh.
So interesting.
Yeah, they don't have to be that way.
I'm just cracking up because I met this guy one time who wouldn't wear a pink shirt. He just wouldn't do it. It was like the only shirt. And he was just like, no, thanks. I'll just wear this dirty shirt instead. And it was like, why? It's just like, that's hilarious. It's genuinely hilarious.
Yep. Like,
you just decided that if you wear that color, it's just a color. Then it's going to determine something about you as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Just, ugh.
Yeah. And I think for me, like, I don't know, this is going to sound like super, of course, it dawned on me like recently that because of the way I dress, I too will be like uncomfortable wearing a pink shirt. And it's not because I actually love the color pink and it'd be cool to wear more pink, but I realize that it's like, I could be okay with it, but what I'm not okay with is how people perceive me.
Yeah. Right.
And that's what, like, I don't know, it hit me and I was just like, oh, right. That's the big problem, is like people's perception of me and like perceiving me as one gender over another. It's like, that's the hang up. And so like, how do I get past that?
Sure. Ugh. If you figure it out, will you please let me know?
Just let us know.
What I'm grateful for is I do feel like there's more conversation around what it means to be non-binary than ever before. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, you know, it feels good when someone's like, you don't have to look androgynous to be non-binary. And I'm like, yes, thank you. But I think there's also a layer there that to me is much more specific and has been a big part of my journey, which is like, if your definition of non-binary requires the repression of everything that is effeminate, you fucked up. Like, you missed the mark, friends. Like, non-binary is not like light masculine, just like non-binary is not light feminine. Non-binary is also like a term that sort of describes a collection of gender identities, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there are people who are agender, who for them, any kind of gendering is not appropriate. It's like, I'm so happy for my agender friends that they figured it out. Me, I'm just like, non-binary is very helpful because I just basically have a series of question marks. When someone's like, what's your gender? I'm like, wouldn't I like to know?
Yeah, right? Like, I know, like, somebody asked, I can't remember when this was, but like, I don't know, but I just realized like, I don't have either experience of the binary. Like, I don't have an experience of being a woman and I don't have an experience of being a man. And for me, that's what non-binary is. It's like, I don't know. It's a big question mark. You're right.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as much as I am not always a fan of like apophatic descriptions, like non-Christian or, you know, non-white, I do think with binary, it's really helpful because it's like, I know I'm not these things, but I want to live in this big question mark. And frankly, I want to invite more people to explore the boundaries of what they do know and to say like, okay, so yeah, maybe you are a man, but does it feel good when someone tells you to man up?
Yeah.
Or is that a problem?
Yeah.
Like, let's talk about it. Like, let's also not have a binary on who gets to be non-binary, right? Like,
so
that could be just as problematic.
Yep.
I love non-binary folks. Rhea, you're the best. This is just like
too.
So fun. Yeah. Sarah, did you have any other questions?
No, I feel like I just had to take a moment to bask in everybody's presence there for a second. So.
Yeah, totally. At one point when I was muted, I was just muted because I was crying because this is just so lovely. And it's, you know, you've done a project that it might seem simple, right? Like we're doing Butch Heroes and it's like, yes, but to do that in a way where you don't say people are lesbian, people are trans, and do that in a way where you don't take these anachronistic terms and apply them and instead let the story stand up and be the gender diversity, just letting people's lives stand there and letting a beautifully and lovingly wrought portrait that there's no fucking way any Catholic, you know, there's no sainthood coming for these folks. No one's putting them in the major history books, but goddamn it, we can. And you did. And that to me is such a symbol of hope in a time and in a world where it often feels like there is no hope. And the hope is the fact that we exist, but it's also the fact that we are reclaiming our right to exist. Mm-hmm. And that is so much of what I get from Butch Heroes. I think I told you when we talked before, like I had to read it in very small batches. Mm-hmm. I could only read like 4 profiles at a time because I just needed time to cry after, and reflect on like, oh my God, the resilience, the power, the willingness to be here. And I am healthy. I am with a therapist, people. Please do not freak out. However, I do live with suicidal ideation. It is just a part of my experience of the world. Yeah. And sometimes it's related to gender dysphoria, and sometimes it's just related to my depression. And sometimes I look around and I'm like, what the fuck is this? I didn't sign up for this world.
Totally, totally. Completely understand that.
Yeah, right. I feel like it's very reasonable.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Also seeing a therapist.
Yeah, I am okay. I am not going to hurt myself. And I think that as I was reading the book, so often what I felt was that like they stayed and fought. I can stay and fight.
Yeah.
They lived in their bodies. I can live in this body. They didn't have to choose a perfect label, because the labels we have today didn't exist then, or because, you know, they weren't able to talk about it, which sucks. But either way, I don't have to find a perfect label. Mm-hmm. I can choose a myriad of labels. I can choose one label one day and the next day be like, you know, no more. And I love seeing other people do that. Like the other day I saw someone who was like, hey, I'm going to use she now. I used to use they. They's been good to me. But you know what? She's my pronoun now. And I was like, thank God, people fucking exploring themselves, asking questions, changing their minds. Like, this is the goal, like, to just find out who we are. And when I started to come out as non-binary, I was like, oh, God damn it. I thought I did all this coming out in my 20s. Like, what is happening?
I know, right? It feels like it's an ever-present journey. You're always coming out.
And that is what I realized, too, was that for me, my queerness is a constantly expanding horizon where I don't know who I will be when I reach that horizon, because when I reach it, it won't be the horizon anymore. And there will be another one beyond it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sort of curiously walking through my life like, oh, well, that's surprising. Like the first time I saw Schitt's Creek, I was so attracted to David and I identified with him so strongly. And I was like very confused. Yeah. And then I was like, oh shit, that's like that gender piece I've been sort of leaving in the back of my brain. It's coming out in these moments where I'm like, is that me? Did I just see me on TV as like a rich white guy? That feels weird, but I think that might be me. And I don't know, I just want that for everybody. I want everybody to just be able to figure out who we are, you know?
Yeah, yeah, totally. That's so well said. Yeah.
You are a lot like David from Schitt's Creek.
I really am. Sometimes I'm like, I'm too much even for myself. What are you going to do? Well, this has been, you know, amazing.
This has been great. Thank you.
I'm so happy. Well, if you would like to learn more about Rhea, we're going to have information in the show notes, but make sure to go to their website, rheabrodel.com, and find them on Instagram at Rhea Brodel. If you haven't picked up Butch Heroes, just Google Butch Heroes. The book will come up. And get it. If you can't afford it, pick it up at your library. If your library doesn't have it, help them out. They need to have it. It's an important work. And yeah, Rhea, thank you for being here with us. I was going to say on this snowy day, but I'm not in the same place as you.
It's true. It's like the sun is setting over here. But yeah, thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun. Yeah, it's been great.
Oh, thank you. Sarah, I was expecting your signature. Yeah!
Because I don't know how to segue. Like, I'm not good at it. So I'm just like, oh, so great.
Oh, so great. The end. We are a podcast that is all about making comic books more accessible to LGBTQ folks and women. So if you have a question about anything related to comics, comic adaptations, pop culture in general, conventions, cosplay, you name it, that's what we're here for. You can send us your questions at bitchesoncomics@gmail.com. Unfortunately, Gmail does not like the word bitch.
They're pretty judgy about it. So we can't have it spelled out. It is b.theseonconomics@gmail.com. And do you remember, there's no I'm bitch.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.